and welcome to the This Month in Forensics podcast for November 2018. I'm Phil Moore, and here's a few things from the last month that I wanted to talk about. Of course, this isn't everything. The industry puts out a massive amount of content every week, so for everything that I can find, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. The first thing I wanted to do is send my condolences to the Sanderson family. Paul shared the news of his wife's passing, and as a result, he said he will be taking some time off. So I think I speak for everyone when I said the digital forensics and incident response community sends their support in this very trying time. Okay, and now on to the rest of the show. Andrea Fortuna at So Long and Thanks for All the Fish has released a new tool called Auto Timeline, which seeks to generate a timeline from a provided memory dump. So it looks like a really good starting point for memory analysis with volatility. You throw the memory dump at it, it determines which profile to use and then runs a few scripts, and it allows you to kind of triage at scale because you can dump a whole bunch of memory and then throw it all at it and kind of focus from there, which is always useful to see. There are a couple of comprehensive app analysis posts that I wanted to mention. There are a lot more, but I wanted to choose these because they were on fairly prolific apps. So the first was Michael Godfrey's guest post on Forensic Focus about the various forensic artifacts related to the uTorrent client. For those that don't know, uTorrent is a fairly popular torrenting client, which might be useful to see how Michael has examined. And the next was John Walters at Carpe Indicum's post on the Snapchat app on iOS and Android. And John's gone through the iOS and the Android side and what you'll find on the operating system, what you'll find on the app for that particular operating system. And he kind of walks you through the whole kind of examination process that he used. On the Snapchat note, I didn't know that Snapchat had a takeout feature, so Gary at Salt Forensics explained how you can go about requesting your data, which is great because the takeout features are really useful to see what you would get, especially on the law enforcement side. You can pull down your own data and see what you would get if you were to request that information from the provider. And also, maybe it's more complete than API access, which can change. So you can always, you know, go down that route if you've got credentials. Ashley Hernandez at Black Bag Technology shared a number of useful tips for collecting data from Macs with T2 chips. Apple just basically, originally the T2 chips were only in the Apple Mac Pros, which I guess aren't, well, I mean, they're popular in certain communities, but they're not widely distributed, and just recently Apple updated it so that all of their, I think, MacBook Pros, I think also the iMac line, they had it in the iMac Pro previously, and maybe even the MacBook and MacBook Air, I'm not really sure, have these T2 chips, which basically means that the encryption comes from the chip, and if you remove the drive from, if you can, I guess they're soldered on sometimes, so that's a bit hard, but you basically need to go through the Mac that the drive has been encrypted on to read it, is my understanding. That can cause some problems, especially if I heard a story of someone who handed back their laptop and had completely destroyed all of the ports, and that might cause, you know, major issues when trying to acquire that information. But, you know, Apple likes to keep it fun for us. The article has a few other general tips for Mac acquisition, which are worth noting, so particularly around mounting dirty APFS volumes, which I think, and also you may accidentally clear FS events. I can't recall what that was specifically, but you can always read the article to find out more. It also appears that live data collection will require additional modification to the operating system from the latest version, which I could not pretend to know how to pronounce. Mojave, that's probably not right. Anyway, so from the latest version of the operating system going forward, you actually have to authorize the app to allow collection. And I think you probably... So with Macquisition, the live data collection would work without the user's admin password. And you, if you wanted to acquire memory or if you want to do a live forensic image, then you would need their admin password. But the way I'm reading this is from the latest version onwards, you actually have to make some modifications to the operating system, which could potentially, if the user's locked those settings down, also restrict you. But that might be just for running the acquisition application. I mean, you can always copy and paste, and there are a series of commands that you could run to create your volume and then copying, preserving as much metadata as possible. And I mean, if that's what you've got to do, that's what you've got to do. So as it stands, basically, I'd suggest it's a good idea to have a look at reading this article and kind of getting head around these devices, because that's the way that Apple's headed, and so they're not going to be long before they show up on your desk. Howard Oakley also, he's at the Eclectic Light Company, he also posted a bit about the T2 chip that you might want to look at, and the default settings about encryption and how things kind of fit together. Cindy Murphy at Gilware provides an overview of the JSON files, or what are JSON files basically, and shares some examples of the apps that store data in JSON format. So Cindy explains that this data may be transient, so sometimes you won't get lucky and you won't find content in the files. But either way, it's good that it's good that knowing that they're worth taking a look at, and that can be very helpful, especially in app examinations. Sarah Edwards at Mac Forensics shared her presentation from the recent Objective by the Sea conference, where she introduced her new Apollo framework, which I can't remember what it stands for, but it was something about the Apple something lazy outputter framework. And the tool basically seeks to assist in automatically processing the various SQLite databases that you find on iOS. So I really like the idea of this platform because it opens up that ability to process iOS file system dumps without having to rely on paid tools. People have started getting iOS file system dumps, and it takes time for vendors to catch up. And also then they prioritize what they're seeing their customers require, not necessarily what you require for a case. So frameworks like what Sarah's put together means that if you do some examination on an iOS file system dump and you're able to expand the body of knowledge, then you can create a plugin, which Sarah's made fairly easy to do, and it'll go through, pull out your SQLite databases and parse them and process them and put them out there, which is a lot, it's not a lot easier. It does take a little bit of work, but for people that want to use this type of system, it's great to have the framework already built. I had a brief play around with it, and I think it's going to be important. It's going to help a number of people in their cases and just fill those gaps that are left by vendor tools. Again, not disparaging to vendor tools. They have their priorities and limited resources, and as a result, they can't prioritize your one investigation, but that's where building out this stuff, and if you can push it back to Sarah so that the rest of us can benefit from the research is really, really, really great. Over on my ThinkDFIR blog, I posted the findings of a quick test in Windows 10 where I identified the $i files allocated in the recycle bin, at least within the master file table, weren't accessible via the UI. So initially, it seemed to suggest that these files were deleted and then restored, and then Yogesh Khatri did some additional testing on methods of removing items from the recycle bin to see which one would also remove the $i file. And I think he found that there was one instance, which was if you undo a move, that Windows would run the right processing, which would clean up those $i files. And what this means, obviously, we need to do more testing and try to figure out which use cases these $i files exist under, but or rather remain to exist under. At least we can see, hey, this file was deleted, and then it looks like it was probably restored, which is why you can find indications that the file existed, but not the corresponding $r, which is pretty cool. So I found the same thing happened in Vista. At least I found these $i files that I couldn't necessarily explain. Maybe this process has been that way since Vista, but it's just interesting to know, and at least that way we can have a sort of explanation that we can provide. I did mention in the post that I ran my $i test files, and I created a couple info twos as well through a number of tools, but by and large they all operated the same, and I sent my testing results over to Eric, and he threw a quick tool together overnight, which was fun. I sent all the details to him on Friday at 11 o'clock at night, and wake up in the morning to a bucket load of emails and a new tool. Overall, you should find that the DollarEye and the Info2 parsers function the same, with their main difference being the output formats and their user interfaces and whether they parse an individual file or a directory. But because it's a fairly simple file format, most of them seem to operate just fine. Like, I didn't find any that really operated badly, or at least couldn't be rectified fairly quickly. So yeah, I mean, the main point of my post was just to show that the reason that $i files were remaining was when files were restored. Anyway, Yogesh also had a post looking into the .underscore files that Mac OS uses to store extended attributes on non-Apple file systems. Everyone sees them, and everyone, I mean, largely people would ignore them. But for those that don't know, what happens is you copy a file from a Apple file system, say HFS or OPFS, onto an XFAT or a FAT file system, and it will copy all of the extended attributes out of the existing file and then put them in a .underscore file with the file name appended to the end of that. And then what happens is that file's hidden, and when you copy the file back off, it will merge the two back together. Interestingly, if you use an NTFS driver, I think it uses the alternate data streams, but again, that depends on the driver. Apple doesn't natively write to NTFS, so you know, your mileage may vary. But generally, I think people probably overlook these .underscore files, but they could be very useful, and it's cool that Yogesh put together the file format so that we can potentially, someone can write a script that will parse these out. Which might give you a bit more information about where these files came from. I've found email addresses, for example, that showed that a file was downloaded from an email, which might be very useful to say, you know, this file was found on this person's thumb drive that was in their possession, and it, you know, they're claiming they don't know about it, but then why was it downloaded from their email account? Which is pretty cool. So, really happy to see that. So, moving on, Brett Shavers has started an initiative to pass some digital forensics and incident response books on. So by signing into the social side of the DFID.training website, yeah, you go into the running to win a book. And the only ask is that when you read it, you pay it forward afterwards. Highlight a passage that you found helpful, you know, write your notes in it if you really want. But the idea is to give it to someone else. Harlan Carvey was able to donate a couple of his books, and Brett has as well. And the winners have been drawn for the first month, maybe the second month as well, I'm not sure. And they have been shipped to their first winners, basically. So hopefully these will be read and marked up and forwarded on to someone else to benefit from. It's a nice idea to see just how far the books can get from home. But also, like, it's Brett trying to encourage people to, you know, read a bit, write a bit, push it on to someone else, especially for people that don't necessarily buy those books to begin with. It just gives them a chance to get it. So, wish him well for that competition. Speaking of books, Dave Cohen has announced a new book that he's working on called Windows Forensics DFIR in Depth. The idea around the book is really cool. Dave is self-publishing. He wrote a post about the self-publishing process and why he's decided to go that way. And basically, he's able to post a chapter, and once it's done, he can publish it so that we all can read it. And once he, basically can go back, once he's found new information and fill in the blanks and say, well, actually, this is what I thought at the time, but that's not true anymore, and here's the testing as to why. Print media, especially in technology, as we know, can get outdated relatively quickly. And outdated isn't necessarily the right term, because it is the author's understanding at the time of publication. I've heard from people that have published books that they don't necessarily get as much control as they might like. They don't necessarily get to publish another version, an updated edition. They don't really get to fix any issues after it's, you know, out to publishing, which includes spelling errors and all of that. So this kind of method, which Dave has chosen, is quite cool, and we'll see how it works out. It really allows him to iterate and test through more scenarios and document his understanding as he goes along. We also get to see I think he can just hit publish on a chapter because he has that level of control, and we can see what's happening as it's being written. I know people have had issues in the past where they've, you know, written their book and had no feedback throughout their process, where people knew they were writing the book, and then afterwards they've gone, oh, well, why didn't it cover X, Y, and Z? And the response is, well, I didn't know that you wanted that to be covered, which, you know, it's hard because people aren't mind readers on all sides. So this gives Dave a little bit more focus for his testing, and it just means that, you know, for example, we'll be able to pull the chapter on process execution tracking and see what Dave has found rather than piecing together all of his blog posts, of which there are numerous now that he's, you know, writing daily and testing daily and sharing his tests. So, you know, on the note of testing, Dave was able to find a few interesting things during his testing on USB devices. He connected a USB 3 drive, and he noticed that it wasn't showing up in its usual location, and then as a result he found the device container's subkey, which basically, but the Windows operating system now uses the store port driver for large USB drives, such as an external hard drive. And Dave did some testing with Jason Hale's USB detective, and he wanted to see how that tool coped and changed with the change in operation, because, you know, Windows changes something on the back end in the next version, and all of a sudden all our tools break for a period of time. Jason's already updated USB detective, I think the latest version. It did manage to cope using the variety of other artifacts that it uses to piece together that information, but, you know, Jason's already updated it. It does show that you can't necessarily just rely on, in this instance, you know, the USB registry key. You know, you have to piece together all of those pieces. There's pieces and pieces and pieces. You can look in a whole bunch of different places in the registry, in the file system, event logs, for example, and you can put all that information together and you'll see USB device activity. And that's where Jason's tool does a really good job. But as Dave discovered, you know, if you're just looking in one place, you will miss large USB devices. Dave also posted a number of test kitchens looking into the Shimcache and Amcache. So lots of findings from, don't even know how many, I think it was 4 or 5 test kitchens that Dave has done. He's doing them almost daily now. I would suggest reading through the summaries because Dave's going through and trying to find the gaps in understanding around how the subsystem functions. What populates it, what the populated artifacts mean, how can we use them. So for example, we found that the Amcache isn't always a reliable method of determining program execution. The timestamp could indicate when the computer was restarted, or it could indicate when there's a task scheduled at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's great to show that the executable existed in its location at that time, but not necessarily that it was executed at that time. I think it was on Windows 10. I have to review his findings, but then ultimately in the book it's going to have, I'm sure, this is what we know about Windows 7, this is what we know about Windows 10, whatever it is, so it'll be easy to piece together. I do notice that I mention Dave every month because he's really bringing the goods. He's showing that in as little as 20 minutes a day, you can compound that into game-changing discoveries or just a better understanding of how things work. Dave does the testing, he asks a couple of questions, and then he documents what he finds. Not finding something is a finding something is a finding, and either way, he's trying to build out his understanding and then sharing it, so our understanding of a specific thing. And you'll see it in the test kitchens, how he's, you know, testing, you know, one specific circumstance, and then he goes, okay, well, what did we learn? What do we know now? Where are the gaps? Next forensic test kitchen is one of the gaps. And then because he's publishing them, people are conversing, I guess, about what they think it is, and more information comes out of it. So, you know, really looking forward to seeing how it all goes. And because I haven't mentioned Alexis Brignone yet, he was interviewed by Krista at Magnet about his work and his expansion into creating Magnet custom artifacts, Axiom custom artifacts, sorry. So in his interview, Alexis pointed out that people who regularly appear on my blog, for example, have realized that everybody has something to contribute. And to quote the article, Alexa said, it doesn't have to take hours a week, just a few minutes to share what you know so others can build on your work. Even if it's something you believe others know already, share it still. Your way of presenting that knowledge might make a world of difference to someone that has never seen it the way you do. Which, you know, I couldn't agree with more. Which is why, you know, sometimes you've done the work. You've spent half an hour digging into this thing, and you can just spend 10 minutes writing it down. That way, you can just refer back to it. My memory is horrendous. That way, I go back and I go, oh yeah, that's what I found. And this, if, you know, you can get around to it. Screenshots and the test data and whatever it is. It just makes your life easier, and it helps everyone else, which is, you know, I guess what I'm after anyway. Lastly, Magnet Forensics announced the CFP for their 2019 User Summit, which by the time of this posting will be pretty much closed. I think it closes today. So that's okay. The thing that I wanted to point out was their specific mention that you don't need to tie the talk back to Magnet products. They're trying to build a community event rather than just a Magnet event. So I get the feeling that this is what CEIC used to be like before it became Enfuse, which you know, I've mentioned a couple of times, I think is moving away, which is, you know, is a shame. A lot of people said, you know, CEIC used to be great. And, you know, it's a shame when the big industry conferences disappear, and it looks like Magnet might be potentially speaking for them, you know, potentially moving into that kind of gap. And I'm sure it helps with the whole lead generation when Guidance did it, you know, but the main thing is it brings everyone together to talk about things that they like doing. And, you know, if it helps sales, great, but at the end of the day, it's a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun when I was there in May this year, and now it's twice as long, so, you know, that it's worth checking out. I don't think I'll be able to make my way over there next year, but I have spent a bit of time hanging with the Magnet folks, and they're, you know, they're good people, so I imagine they'll put on a good show. Some of the folks at Magnet go above and beyond to their own detriment, and the person knows who I'm talking about. The conference does have a low cost for entry. I think it was only a few hundred dollars, and it's in Nashville, which I imagine is a lot of fun. So if you can make it there, then it's probably worth trying to get there. And that's all for the month. Of course, this isn't everything. For everything that I've found, you can head over to thisweekinforensics.com. For my Patreon and PayPal pledges, subscribers, helper outers, if you, well, firstly, thank you. I really appreciate the support being pushed back to me. If you get a bit of value out of my work and you want to give a little bit of value back, the link is in this poster at the top of the page. For those that don't know, Patreon supporters get the links that I've mentioned as well as the time codes to make it easy to look up. I'm thinking about expanding things. I've got a few ideas whether I do or not to reward the Patreons a little bit more, and if anyone has any ideas, that would be greatly appreciated. But yeah, so I can't appreciate it more, basically. If you've got any suggestions or recommendations, let me know on Twitter. I'm at Phil Moore. Special thanks to my friend Jeff, who is Animatic on SoundCloud, for his tracks. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next month.